Hello and welcome. Today is Friday, August 5th, 2016. And my name is Christine Cox. I'm the Director of Outreach and Advocacy for MITO Action. And I am delighted to welcome today Christy Weiss with Empowered Medical Advocacy. Christy is the mother of a child with a complex medical history and also a tireless patient advocate. We're very lucky to have her here today to talk about medical homes. Christy has extensive experience in this, so I think this is going to be a real, really beneficial conference call. So we will have time for questions and answers at the very end, but in the meantime, I wanted to direct everyone to the slides that Christy has put together. You can find these by going to our website, mitoaction.org, and under most recent news, you will see medical homes. If you click on that, there will be a sidebar that comes up that says join us. Under there, there's a link to the slides. You click view the slides and SlideShare will come up. And you can feel free to click through at your leisure and refer back to any of the slides. It's all self-controlled. And so for now, if you have any questions at all, feel free to email me, Christine Cox, at outreach@mitoaction.org. But I would like to see now if Christy Weiss is on the line. Christy, are you with us?
I'm here, Christine. Can you hear me?
I can. Terrific. Well, Christy, we are so delighted to have you here today. And hopefully everyone has had a chance to find the slides. But I'm going to turn it over to you, so please go ahead.
Great. Thank you first to MITO Action and to you, Christine, and Christy Balcells for the opportunity to present to you today. Thanks so much for having me.
Delighted to have you.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and get started. The title of my talk today, hopefully you can see it there on your screen if you've been able to access SlideShare, is How to Build Your Mitochondrial Medical Home. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on me. Thank you so much, Christine, for the introduction. But I was once new to all of this. In the beginning, I was completely a lost consumer of healthcare. I had a miserable baby girl and a strong mother's instinct that something was very, very wrong. As we pursued that instinct and our family's instinct that something was going on, We went to many practitioners and over the first couple of years had over 20 medical professionals, everything from pediatricians to occupational therapists, from neurologists to nutritionists, involved in trying to figure out this mystery of our little girl. And we had very few answers. Going from an appointment to appointment, as I'm sure many of the parents who may be listening in today can attest, was exhausting and overwhelming. And I have to tell a short story of kind of how I came to this medical home concept of medical record misery, I call it. There was a point in time when our daughter had a endoscopy performed by a GI specialist, and I was communicating with her pediatrician, and she said, "How did the endoscopy go?" And I said, "Well, don't you have the information?" They said they were going to send the information to you about the report. And she said, "No, I don't have that information and I'm not able to access it." And so I, at that moment, thought it was my responsibility to get that information to her. And so I drove to the GI doctor's office across town, about an hour away, got the records and hand delivered them back to our pediatrician. And I just thought that's what I was supposed to do. I was a mom and I didn't know how the system worked. And, I wanted to make sure everyone on my daughter's team at that point had all of the information so we could get to information on how to help her better and more quickly. And so that's what I did. But after I did that numerous times, I finally was so overwhelmed and said, "Who is the quarterback of this team? Who is helping me try to coordinate all of this information?" And that's what brought me to medical home. And I'll share a little bit about that in a moment. Since then, I've learned a lot since those beginning days and continue to learn daily. Acting now as a patient advocate, I learn daily from the experiences and the challenges that my clients faced and trying to help them navigate through that. But my background and why I probably didn't know much about what was going on in the medical world was I was a scientist and a chemist, and that's where my training came from. As I started to dive in and try to figure out answers for my daughter, I got involved with Baby's First Test, which is a newborn screening education organization, and I joined their consumer task force. That helped a lot in kind of seeing things from a national level. I also was part of Mito Action's advocacy task force and really enjoyed being on that and looking at things from a patient advocacy and system advocacy perspective. I currently serve as a social media coordinator for Mountain States Regional Genetics Collaborative, which is a collaborative that's based out of Texas, where we used to live, and I continue to learn. I've learned a lot about medical home from that experience. And I'm the former parent advisor for the Pennsylvania Academy of Pediatrics Medical Home Initiative. And obviously, by my talk's title today, I've learned a lot from that experience as well, specifically on the topic that we're going to talk about. I've authored a number of articles. I write quite a bit for our local parenting magazine. I also blog. And above all else, I really do love advocating for individuals and families, especially those with special health care needs. And currently, I'm working as a patient advocate for my own company, Empower Medical Advocacy, and the information's there. Just a short disclaimer, the medical information in this presentation is just for information resources only and not to be relied on as medical advice for diagnostic or treatment purposes, and I'm not a doctor, so I can't answer specific questions to medical treatment or diagnosis. This is more of talk about navigation of the medical system. So you're probably wondering if you don't already know the answer, what is a medical home? When I first heard the term, I literally thought it was a nursing home for children. And you probably are all chuckling because if you know the real term of it, you know that's very far from the truth, or the real definition of it, you know that's far from the truth. It's best described, I think, here with this definition from the National Center for Medical Home Implementation, which is a joint cooperative between the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Maternal Child Health Bureau. A medical home is not a building or a place. It is actually an approach to providing comprehensive primary care that facilitates partnership between patients, clinicians, medical staff, and families. And so it's a systems delivery term. It's a way of approaching medicine and a way of approaching care for patients. It can also be synonymous with patient-centered medical home, or PCMH, you'll see as an acronym, and the term health home can also be referring to the same thing. With that other term that is brought up there, that patient-centered medical home, you might wonder, what is patient-centeredness and what does that mean? This definition here is from the Institute of Medicine quite a few years ago, 2001, in a report that they did on national healthcare quality. And they define it as patient-centeredness refers to healthcare that establishes a partnership among practitioners, patients, again, their families, to ensure that decisions respect patients' wants, patients' needs and preferences, and that patients have the education and support they require to make decisions and participate in their own care. So this is really saying you as a patient, or you as a patient's parent acting on behalf of half of your child, should be at the center of your care, and that you should be a member of the team, and that care should revolve around your preferences, your wants and needs. So what does that look like? I'm not a great artist, but with the help of PowerPoint, this is what I envision a medical home looks like. There's a little oval there with a question mark in it, and there could be many ovals with question marks in it, because depending on what needs you or your child has, there could be many, many more circles to this diagram. Just some of the things you can see there: the hospital, pharmacy, OTPT, speech, work, school, insurance, specialist. For anyone who's been in the mitochondrial disease community for a while, you know that all these things are important for having a quality of life and improved quality of life for your child. But trying to coordinate all of them can be overwhelming to many families. So the medical home sits at the center. It's a primary care office or position, and the patient is at the center of that practice, and then that entity coordinates and communicates with all these others. Why are we talking about the idea of a medical home? If you are familiar with healthcare and how healthcare has worked for quite a number of years, it's been a fee-for-service model. And that means, you know, you perform a service, whether that be an office visit, whether that be an x-ray, whether that be an MRI, and the insurance reimbursed or the individual pays for that service, so a fee-for-service model. But this model has rewarded quantity and not quality of care. And so a provider gets paid regardless of what happens after that service is provided. You really don't differentiate in our healthcare system between effective and ineffective encounters. And as we all know, are probably very aware, healthcare spending is on the rise, insurance rates have been on the rise, and so there is this move to focus on focus away from productivity and more to a model focused on improved health outcomes. So focusing on the actual health of the patient rather than how many patients can be seen. In the Affordable Care Act, Section 2703, it specifically notes the term health homes in being used for providing care of chronically ill patients. And so that's where you'll see a linkage to current policy. Just a little bit of background. I think it's always good to kind of look backwards to kind of understand where we are today, and it's been quite a road. And again, when I jumped in this 7 years ago, I had no idea of this history, and most people wouldn't. As a consumer or as a parent of a child that's having health difficulties, you might not know any of this is even being talked about for over 40 years. So the American Academy of Pediatrics first introduced the concept of medical home really for special needs children in the idea of where their medical records would be housed. And so really that's where the conversation started back in 1967. In 1992, they came out with a policy statement about medical home, an official American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement. And then in 2002, they revised that statement, and they came up with certain areas that or certain terms that should encompass medical home. Medical home should be accessible, continuous, comprehensive, family-centered, coordinated, compassionate, and culturally effective. And that is how they defined a medical home. In 2004, the American Academy of Family Physicians came out with a paper or information on medical home. And then in 2006, the ACP, which is the American College of Physicians, came out with their terminology and their statement on advanced medical home. And then in 2007, these groups came together and formed the joint principal statement. We're on slide 10 now, and you can see that the joint principles of patient-centered medical home is a document that was agreed upon by all of these organizations. So the American Academy of Family Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics, American College of Physicians, and the American Osteopathic Association. These four groups came together in 2007 and came up with the joint principles. And just to give you a little overview on slide 11, what the joint principles actually are, these are just the bullet point highlights of them, but I'm going to give you a little bit of background of what these terms mean. But again, these four organizations agreed upon this, that this is the joint principles of patient-centered medical home and what should be strived for when setting up a medical home type environment for a practice. So the first one is personal physician. They believe that each patient has an ongoing relationship with a personal physician trained to provide first contact, and that's going to be very important. We'll talk about that in a little bit, continuous and comprehensive care. Physician-directed medical practice is the second bullet point there. And that idea is that the personal physician is going to lead a team of individuals at the practice level who collectively take responsibility for the ongoing care of patients. Whole person-oriented, we've kind of heard some of this before with the term patient-centeredness and family-centeredness, but that whole person orientation is saying that the personal physician is responsible for providing all of the patient's health care needs or taking responsibility for appropriately arranging care with other qualified professionals. And this includes all stages of life, from acute care to chronic care to preventative services and even to end-of-life care. So that is saying that this person, this primary physician, takes responsibility for all of that, whether it be the services that are provided in their office or working with other professionals. And that's the fourth bullet point there, the care coordination is coordinated, or care is coordinated or integrated. And I found over the years that term is kind of nebulous, and it's hard for parents and family members to kind of say, well, what is care coordination? It sounds like it encompasses a lot, and it does. I'm going to read you two definitions of it because I think between both of these, it kind of clears that up a little bit for families. Care coordination care is coordinated or integrated across all elements of complex healthcare systems. And that can mean subspecialty care, hospitals, home health agencies, nursing homes, and the patient's community, including family and public, private, community-based services. Care is facilitated by registries, information technology, and health information exchange, and other means to assure that patients get indicated care when and where they need it and want it culturally and linguistically appropriate manner. I think the American Academy of Pediatrics on their medical home site has a great description of care coordination as well. And they refer to it as the deliberate organization of patient care activities between two or more participants, including the patient, involved in the patient's care to facilitate the appropriate delivery of healthcare services. In their coordination of care, medical, social, behavioral professionals, the educational system, payers, medical equipment providers, home care agencies, advocacy groups, needed supportive therapies and services, and families. So as you can see, it's that idea that we have all of these different circles and ovals that need to all talk to one another and all need to be on the same page, and that is what the term care coordination encompasses. So the next couple bullets there, quality and safety. There's a big focus on quality improvement in the joint principles statement happening at the practice level, but that it impresses upon that the patient is actively participating and giving feedback to the practice so that they can continue to improve the quality that is given. And enhanced access. This is a concept of being able to access care when you need it and where you need it. So that can be done through things called open scheduling, extended office hours, and new options for communications between patients and their physicians, such as you might be familiar with patient portals. That comes under the term there of enhanced access. And then payment. Obviously, these are groups of individuals that represent physicians, and being paid for this additional time that it takes to coordinate care is a very important in this joint principles statement. And so in their payment statement, they say that it should reflect the value of physician and non-physician staff that would fall outside of that face-to-face visit. And it should also support provisions to enhance communication access, such as email and telephone consultations that might not be a face-to-face visit. They're promoting here and advocating that those all need to be paid for, since that's additional time that will be spent with the patient. So those are the joint principles, and that was in 2007. So at that time, this report by the Robert Graham Center said this model is an aspiration that is not currently found in most clinical practices, and it's available and is unavailable to most people in the U.S. And what they were calling for then was it was going to be an important evolution of care, and it was going to require active demonstrations, change facilitation, and a business plan that either can survive in the current payment environment, which again was that fee-for-service model, or that it's specifically financed, meaning that the payment system would change to encompass medical home. So that was 2007, and next year we'll be coming up on 10 years from that joint principles statement. And so where are we now? I would say that we are still implementing and still in ongoing implementation across the United States. Medical homes are being set up across the nation, but it is still a process and does not, unfortunately, for many patients that are in need of this, happen overnight. For the pediatric population specifically, based on the information found at the medical home info, again, through the American Academy of Pediatrics there, they have shown, demonstrations have been shown, it has been demonstrated that there is an association between access and utilization of a medical home and the following things, including decreased hospitalizations, decreased visits to the emergency room, and less out-of-pocket spending for families, particularly those with public insurance. So this model really is lowering costs, not only to the families, but also to insurance providers and medical systems. But in the end, it's also focusing on that patient care and the quality of care, not just the quantity of care that person is receiving. So something else has happened since 2007, and that is medical home accreditations. And so there have been a number of organizations that have come about that are now accrediting or giving certain levels of awarding a certain level to medical homes who have reached certain criteria. This medical home accreditation is often needed to obtain an increased reimbursement rate from a health plan. So for you as a patient or a patient's parent, these accreditations may not impact you directly and directly your patient care. These individual organizations do have searchable databases available, though, and that's why I listed them here, as it might be a first step if you are looking for a place that does have the mentality of patient-centered care, that you can search for who has gotten accreditation. So it's NCQA seems to be the largest organization that's accrediting patient-centered medical homes, and they each have different terminology for what they're accrediting, which are there in red on slide 14. The Joint Commissions is another one, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, and then Utilization Review Accreditation Commission. Some of these programs have been criticized, though, for being too administratively focused, and again, that's why I put that caveat that you may or may not see the impact of these accreditations on your patient care, because a lot of them can be focused on checking the box, focused on making sure you have a procedure for this or a procedure for that, and they might not be solely focused on the bigger picture, which is that patient-centeredness piece that we talked about. I wanted to talk real quickly on a pediatric topic, specifically children with special health care needs. You'll see that referred to as CSHCN or CYSHCN, and that just means children and youth with special health care needs. And the reason I bring this up is because this is where medical home, at least in the American Academy of Pediatrics, was first focused. It was focused on those children with the greatest health needs or the special health care needs in getting access to that medical home. What I'd like to talk about with this is whenever I started with, working with the Pennsylvania Academy of Pediatrics and their medical home project, I was kind of confused to what did a child with special health care needs look like? Was that my child, or was that my friend with the child with a severe peanut allergy, or was that my other friend with a child with autism? All of them had special health care needs, but all very different needs from one another. So the Maternal Child Health Bureau of Health and Human Services Division of the U.S. government has a definition. It's that birth to 21 for children who have had an increased risk for a chronic physical, developmental, behavioral, or emotional condition, and who are also require health and related services of a type or an amount beyond that required by children generally. And they do make a caveat that this does not only encompass those children who have complex disorders who require technology, such as G-tube or trach, but it also encompasses children who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, diabetes, emotional disorders, autism. These can all be included in that definition. And one of the main reasons this is a focus for a medical home specifically is that this population is estimated to comprise about 13% of the pediatric population that's seen in pediatric offices, but it accounts for 70% of the pediatric healthcare spending and expenditures. So as you might realize, if you are a parent with a child with mitochondrial disease, this statement is probably true. With all the complex needs, with all the many specialists involved, the healthcare spending goes up tremendously. And what we found personally for our situation is when you don't have coordinated care, when all those bubbles and circles aren't talking to each other, there's a lot of room for duplication of testing. There's a lot of room for things being done that could have been streamlined, where a lot of healthcare expenses can go up and be higher rather than when you're coordinating that care and really looking at the best way and the most efficient way to do it for the health of the child and for the needs of the child. So some of these medical home examples, I just pulled a couple that I knew of nationwide for specifically with children with special health care needs, because I imagine most of the folks listening to this call are in that category, especially if you have a child with mitochondrial disease or who's being worked up for mitochondrial disease. When I was working with the Pennsylvania American Academy of Pediatrics, I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Renee Churchy, and she runs a clinic at St. Christopher's Hospital in Philadelphia, and it is a pediatric clinic. She is a pediatrician, but she only sees special needs children at her clinic. So they have a staff, they have social workers, they have care coordinators all on board to be able to help with whatever that family needs to get or to navigate for their child with special health care needs. There are a couple other examples as well in Washington, D.C. at the Children's National Health System. There's a complex care program, and just heard about one in Houston, Texas with UT physicians called the Chosen Clinic, and that is, again, a special needs clinic, pediatric clinic for individuals with your children with special health care needs. So there's some other examples, and I put the link there, and I think Christine said that she had added that to the blog post, so it's clickable, so you don't have to type all that in. If you just check where you looked for the slides, there should be a link to that. But the medical home info page at American Academy of Pediatrics has highlighted some promising practices. Now, hopefully there's some close to you, but chances are there you might, if you're a little bit more remote and not in one of these more urban centers, you might not have one of those close to you, and that is what I want to talk about next. On slide 17, I want to give you some pointers on what does this mean for me or my child with mito. As I've kind of shown you with some of the background history, healthcare is really in a transition phase right now in how things are being done, moving from the fee-for-service to payment for outcome type situation. As I mentioned, there are medical homes that do exist. I call it organic. There's some that are just out there because they want to provide good patient care and they have this model in their office already. And then some are existing or coming into existence because of the accreditation process. But unfortunately, as I said again, one of those might not be close to you nearby your town, and you know, for being a primary care facility, you don't want to have to drive 5 hours to see your pediatrician or your family doctor. So if you do not currently have a medical home environment that encompasses some of the things that we've talked about before, that patient-centeredness piece, you may have to build your own. And how do we do that? Well, we start with that primary piece, that center of the wheel, the foundation of your medical home. Who is the quarterback of your medical team? And I know in talking with many families who have children with mitochondrial disease, many times they'll tell me, well, that's my mitochondrial specialist, and we have to travel to California to see that person, or we have to travel to Arkansas to see that person. And while that is working for them right at this moment, and that might be a model that's working for them, I would advise everyone to look at having that other piece, a primary piece of their medical home, be a family physician or a pediatrician. And I'll bring up some instances of why that might be important later, but really having somebody that can be close by you, that you don't have to travel to see as that primary hub, is very important. I put a couple examples here. Most people know MD stands for medical doctor. Some people don't know that some doctors have DO after their name. And I put that in because one of the organizations in the joint principles is the osteopathic profession. And so DO stands for Doctor of Osteopathic. They have similar training to MDs, but slightly different in that they do receive training in the musculoskeletal system and your body's interconnectedness of nerves, muscles, and bones. I put some other terms here I wanted to put down because I think so many people, especially with children, think, well, the person that has to be at the center has to be a pediatrician because that's a doctor for kids. And while that's true, I think there's some other options for families, especially if you don't have a pediatrician nearby that practices a medical home model. So you can always look at family physicians. You can have a pediatrician. Sometimes a developmental pediatrician might be more appropriate because they might be more in tune with some of the other challenges your child is having. An internal medicine doctor can be helpful. General practitioner. These are all different names for, you know, types of people who can be that primary piece to your medical home. If you're an older adult and have mito, maybe you've had a late onset of mito, a geriatrician specifically sees individuals that are 65 and older and can be more in tune with some of the things that are going on with aging as well as your condition. And then I wanted to bring up this subcategory called med peds. And I didn't learn about this until I was doing my work with the American Academy of Pediatrics. This is a doctor who is duly trained in internal medicine and pediatrics. And though they're few and far between, there's not hundreds and thousands of them probably in your town. If there is a college that has a program for MedPeds, which are available on the website, if you look for the MedPeds Association, there may be some in your nearby your town that may have come out of that training organization. The good thing about a MedPeds physician is that when you're with a pediatrician, your child will age out of a pediatrician's office, meaning that pediatricians are coming up with transition ages for their office. Many times it's 21 years old, sometimes it's 26. And after that point, they can no longer see your child and provide them care, which means that your child and now adult needs to transition to a adult care doctor, such as a family physician. So a med peds trained person can actually see the child from birth until death because they are duly trained in both. And so therefore they do not have to transition a person to another doctor when they reach a certain age. So I just wanted to mention that. That was something new to me and something that can be very helpful for families. And also, on the other end, if you are having to transition your teen or young adult out of a pediatrician's office, you may want to look for a MedPeds doctor because of their training in pediatrics. They are sometimes more comfortable with childhood chronic illnesses and might be a good match for that if you're having to transition out of a pediatric office into another type of medical home type environment. They might be able to fit the bill for that for your child because they might have some more training and knowledge in pediatric disorders. And then last but not least, functional medicine and integrative doctors can also serve as that hub. One of the drawbacks here for some people is that oftentimes this grouping of individuals do not take insurance. And so oftentimes they're set up as a private pay person, but their training does focus on looking at the whole person and not just separate body systems. And so sometimes I've worked with clients that have found a lot of help in seeing this person. Maybe they pay out of pocket for their advice, and then they're able to get a little bit better picture of how their health is interconnected and how their mitochondrial issues are interconnected to some of their other concerns. So where do you find your quarterback? I'm on slide 19 now. Here's just a list of a couple places that you can look. I want to have a shout out to Mary Beth Hollinger, who's the Mito Action 411 coordinator, nurse coordinator, because she gave me a bunch of ideas for this as well. Always word of mouth referrals are great, but asking others in the medical profession, this was specifically Mary Beth's point, especially nurses. Nurses know where the good doctors are. Therapists and even specialist staff can be helpful in knowing who are the doctors that have really good communication with other specialists, who are the ones that write good referral letters. So asking those other medical professionals for referrals is a good place too. Asking other patients or other patient families who have complex conditions or chronic conditions, specifically in your community, who their primary physician is and what their experience has been, can be really helpful because you're looking, within your own community, but you're also finding out who is not scared or not timid in managing complex conditions. Message boards can be helpful, but I do have a disclaimer there that buyer beware. One patient may have a great experience with a practitioner and another may have a horrible experience with that same practitioner. So I think it's really difficult in our electronic world these days to just, take one person's word with as gold. So I think it's really important to reach out to a person who has had either a good or bad experience and kind of talk to them more about what constitutes that experience so you can draw your own opinions before you reach out to that provider. This is one that I found helpful, especially when we had to move to a new area, with community educational events. So doctors oftentimes speak in the community. They might give a lecture. They might give a talk at a local library, maybe a parenting class. Go listen to them. Oftentimes these are very either free or very low charge admission type things. And it's a great way to see what a person's like, what their personality is like, what their communication is like before you're on the exam table. And then I always encourage people to ask about a new parent or new patient consult. This is not universal in healthcare, but especially in the pediatrics realm, I found most pediatricians are willing to do this, especially if you're expecting, which they do this a lot for new parents who are expecting their first child or second child. But if you say that you really would like a few minutes to talk with the physician before you actually are their patient, sometimes they will honor this for a free consult, just ask questions, not a medical consult. So once you kind of have your list of maybe some possible quarterbacks for your team, you have to call the office and you have to make that first step. Being polite and courteous are always the golden rule. You can simply say, I'm calling to find out if Dr. Quarterback is taking new patients, and they'll let you know. That has to be the first question, because unfortunately, some of the best physicians are full to capacity and they don't have the ability to see new patients. So if they are, then you can just let them know that you were referred to her and you would like to speak with her about possibly being your primary physician. And then I always, as I said, encourage asking. All they can say is no, but it's worth asking if they offer a new patient consultation or any opportunity to speak with the physician. To ask a few questions prior to that first appointment. If they say no, then your next step would be to schedule a time, an actual appointment, introductory appointment with them to speak with them about your medical concerns. One other question that can be helpful in asking the staff is if they know if the doctor that you're inquiring about is comfortable working with patients who have multiple specialists. I hesitate to say a complex chronic condition such as mitochondrial disease on this first call, and the reason being is that if that staff person doesn't know what you're talking about, they're going to probably say no, and that might not reflect actually if the doctor is or is not willing to help coordinate a complex care. So I really feel like that's a question that's better asked directly to the physician. On slide 21, I do have a list here of some possible questions that you can ask on that first visit whenever you are actually face-to-face with the physician that you are interested in having as your quarterback of your medical home team. You can ask how their office operates. I think it's always good to know kind of what goes on in the office and how is best for you to work with them. One question that's very important to people is, will I be scheduled with you each time, and will I see you if I'm sick? In large practices, sometimes it's the case that you will get whoever's available. But if you're really trying to form a relationship and have a quarterback of your team, I encourage you to seek out individuals or practices that will allow you to see the same person each time. And I know this can't be 100% all the time, but one that has a mentality that we would like to see you as often as possible in these situations can be helpful in scheduling that. Another question, as we mentioned before, is how comfortable are you working with complex care and chronic conditions? Another one is, have you ever heard of mitochondrial disease, or what do you know about mitochondrial disease? I want to caution everyone here, though, that this should not be a deal breaker. I know I've been guilty of this, and I've talked to many other families that were like, you know, I went in and they know what mitochondrial disease was. So there's no possible way I can work with this person because they don't even know what it is. And I think that's the wrong approach to take. I have found that there are primary care physicians out there that might know just what they learned in medical school, maybe one page about mitochondrial disease in medical school, that have been excellent quarterbacks of people's teams. Because really what you're looking for is for them to be healthier navigator of the medical system, not necessarily be an expert in mitochondrial disease. You probably have found that person through a specialist that might be specializing in mitochondrial disease, and really you're just looking for this person to help you coordinate with that person as well as all the other pieces of you or your child's care. I think the most important question to ask is, are you willing to learn alongside me about mitochondrial disease? And really the best folks that we've found on personally for our daughter's team and then what I've seen work for other families is that when you find that person who's willing to learn and who's willing to converse with you and have an open conversation and open dialogue about mitochondrial disease, that person can be the most valuable advocate to have on your team. A couple other questions. What's your philosophy on being a primary care physician, pediatrician? So just asking them kind of how they see their role can be quite telling. And what role do you feel the parent or patient plays on the care team? If that person, you know, that doctor that you're interviewing says, well, you know, I'm the doctor, whatever I say goes, and, you know, I understand you're the parent, but it's really my decision. Then if you're looking for patient-centeredness or patient-focused care, that might not be the best fit for you. If alternatively they say, you know, I believe the parent is the key part of the team and you're with the patient, you're with the child every day, and so your input is hugely valuable to me, then that might be more what you're looking for if you are looking for that patient-centered, family-centered approach. And how do you facilitate communication with other members of the care team, both within and outside of your office? Is this person willing to pick up the phone and call a specialist? Is this person willing to communicate with other specialists via email? This is really important to understand how best they like to communicate with other members of the team. And for some people, it's very important what hospital they refer to, especially if you are in a situation where your needs are more critical and you have had to have frequent hospitalizations. This might be an important question to ask as well, to make sure it's somewhere that you feel comfortable being referred to. On the first few visits with this person, I just have a couple pointers here. consider bringing an advocate. That can be anyone from a family member to a friend, just to have another set of ears there listening. Be prepared to share your health history concisely. And I caution this for everyone, because I know I've fallen into this this trap as well, where you want to tell them every single thing that's happened with your child, but you have to be cognizant and you have to be respectful of their time. So I recommend having your medical records available, but not planning to go in and discuss every single page of your medical record or your child's medical record. Have them available so that they can peruse them at their leisure, or if you're talking about a specific test or a specific procedure, you know, you can have the page there to refer to. You really do need to set reasonable expectations for appointment length. In primary care today, the average length of time that patients are with a primary care physician is 8 to 15 minutes, and this is an incredibly short amount of time. One tip would be to, on these first couple appointments, especially if they're non-urgent, non-sick visits, to ask when you're scheduling, say that your care is a little bit more complex, and would it be possible to have a little bit more time with the physician scheduled. Some offices are able to accommodate that. Some offices are able to get reimbursed for that if they have a more complex patient. So giving that heads up to the office staff is helpful, and they will let you know if that's possible or not. Definitely have a list of questions. I can't emphasize this enough, but don't go in with a list of 20. If you do go in with a list of 20 because you can't possibly narrow it down, make sure you've kind of highlighted your top 3 to 5, because those might be the ones that you get to, and you want to make sure that those most important ones are answered first. I highly, highly recommend discussing situations before they become emergencies. Especially if you've had these experiences before. Sometimes we don't know what an emergency is until we've actually gone through it. So I'll put a couple of examples here for a child who, with possible mitochondrial disease, if they've been vomiting for 24 hours, what do I do? Do I call you? Do I go to the ER? What do you want me to do, and what should be our plan of action? What if the child hasn't eaten for a day or a couple days? What if you're an adult, maybe you've had muscle weakness that's lasted for a week and you've seen no improvements? Do I schedule an appointment with you to come in and see you? You know, what is the plan? And then again, communication is so important. So ask the doctor what their communication preferences are. If you want to talk specifically with them, do they have a patient portal? Do they have email? Do they utilize email with patients through the patient portal? When you have phone calls, will you always be talking to a nursing staff, or is it possible to talk with the doctor directly, and how does their office facilitate that? I'm going to move on to slide 23. And again, in these first few visits, and as you maintain and grow this relationship with this person, I think it's really important to not expect this person to now become an expert on mitochondrial disease. Patients, as we know, in chronic and rare disease communities often become experts in their own condition because of their vested interest in feeling better and in having improved quality of life. So those tools that you might have come across, you know, already on your journey, share them with your doctor. Don't make them start from square one and have to go digging. If you have a great resource that you've read about, that perhaps a medical paper or medical journal or something like that, share it with them. And you know, don't overwhelm them with it, but just say, hey, I came across this and thought you might enjoy reading a copy. Here's a couple resources on this page, on page 23, and Christine put these up on the blog site as well, so they're clickable links. But I can't say enough about MitoActions work in this area. They really have done a tremendous amount of work in preparing families and preparing resources for doctors. They have a clinician's guide to the management of mitochondrial disease, manuals for primary care providers. They also have podcasts, just like the one we're doing here today that's being recorded. They have 114 podcasts to date on iTunes that go all the way back to 2007 and on every imaginable topic that relates to mitochondrial disease. Letting your doctor know this is a resource for them as well, being able to listen to world-class physicians gastrointestinal effects in mitochondrial disease and psychiatric links to mitochondrial disease. This is a treasure trove for any physician because it gives them direct information about the condition they're trying to help you manage. Christy Balcell's book is amazing, and though it's for patients and parents and families, it says they're on the cover. I think it can be an amazing handbook for physicians as well. So maybe buying a copy of that and giving it to them or lending a copy to your physician would be helpful. Also, UMDF has an annual symposium where doctors speak and give lectures, and those are all archived on Vimeo. So that can be also another resource for your doctor. And just to talk about sick visits really quickly, we've talked about those emergencies before they happen, but I believe it's very important to see your medical provider, your medical home provider, and that doctor in good times and in bad. They do need to see you or your child at your baseline, which would be a good day, and they need to see when you're not at your baseline, which would be a bad day. If you are having a difficult time deciding if you need to seek more urgent care, we need to remember those joint principles and that idea of first contact and that idea of the personal physician. They should be the ones you call first before you head to the ER, before you head to the hospital, before you head anywhere to the urgent care. You really should try to call them first and ask to be seen if the situation allows. Primary care doctors have the ability to call ahead to ER, to the emergency rooms, and let them know you're on their way if they're sending you. And this can be a tremendous way to help them advocate for you in your emergency care. And then when you get there at the emergency room, at least they know you're coming, at least they know you're showing up, and then they know also not to turn you away and send you back home because they're communicating, hopefully, with that primary care doctor. In the mitochondrial world, sometimes you'll hear the terminology about emergency protocol letters. And I think this is hugely important as well to have this discussion. Usually mitochondrial specialists are the ones to write these letters, but I think it can be very helpful to make sure that your medical home team and your physician has a copy of that, but that if they are even willing to write one or add a page to that letter locally, so that perhaps your mitochondrial specialist is in a different state, then you have a local physician in the state where you would be seen that has also added to that emergency protocol letter. It can add a lot of validity when you are in an emergency situation, and also having a local contact that they can reach out to. And then some ongoing communication. This is just for those other spokes of the wheel. You want to make sure all your medical releases are signed at all your specialists, and that is allowing those specialists to send their clinic notes back to your medical home team and for them to communicate back and forth with each other. But then also, I always encourage parents and patients to ask for a copy of those clinic notes to come to you as well so that you can have your own medical binder of information. Calling ahead before your appointment to make sure all the clinic notes have been received since your last appointment. So say you've seen gastroenterology and neurology since the last time you've seen your primary care provider, you can call ahead to their staff and say, did you get neurology's note and did you get gastroenterology's note? And if they haven't, please encourage them to get those notes and reach out to them. And when you see the medical home provider, update them on who you've seen. You do not need to go into the details of what they've said, because you really want to refer back to that clinic note. Did you get gastroenterology's clinic note? Could we discuss that together based on my appointment? And then use that as a starting point. And then if not, if they don't have those copies, if you're an empowered patient and you're able to get copies of those, then you can provide them ones that can be scanned into their file if you're maintaining your own medical records copies. And last but not least, consider an advocate. An advocate, as I mentioned before, can be anyone from a friend or a relative to a paid professional. There is a growing field of professional advocates out there, and they can be employed by a doctor's office, a hospital, health insurance company, or they can be employed by the patient themselves. Private independent patient advocates can be hired by a patient or a patient's family, and they can assist in navigating the care for their loved ones, and they can be that person that can help you find that quarterback for your draft picks, a list of draft picks for your quarterback of your team, and then help you communicate with them effectively. There is an advocate directory online through advoconnection.com, and it lists advocates in all different areas, ones that can help with insurance reimbursements to ones that can help with pediatric care to elderly care. They have a number of different categories you can search under. And then if you're interested in getting involved in this medical home conversation at a national level, again, this is something that's going on in healthcare nationally. There are some genetics collaboratives. They're called the Regional Genetics Collaborative. You can see the map there. They're all across the United States, and there's conglomerations of certain states for each area. But there's a national coordinating center for all of these regional collaboratives called NCC, and their website's there, nccrcg.org. And you can reach out to them and say, hey, I'm a consumer. I have a child with a genetic condition, or I'm a consumer and have a genetic condition myself, and I'd like to get involved with my regional collaborative. And they have some opportunities that you can get involved, and they can connect you with the one that you live in. And just a couple last resources here. Again, the MITO Action MITO Navigator Toolkit that came out of the advocacy work group that I was on, and it talks a little bit about medical home in there and medical records. Again, I can't say enough about Mary Beth Hollinger and her, the amazing resource that we have in her through MITO Action as a nurse coordinator. She can be one of the people that can help you navigate this crazy world of medical care. And she's available through this 1-888-MITO-411 number. The AAP's National Center for Medical Home Implementation, I've referred to quite a few times, and they have a treasure trove of information about pediatric medical home implementation on their website. And there's also a patient-centered primary care collaborative that has some information. If you just wanted an overview of medical home, there's a great video out there at this link, and that, again, that should be on the blog page. And one book that I found helpful in growing as an advocate is called Being an Empowered Patient, an Advocacy Guide, and that's by Dr. Balfour. So last but not least, there's my contact information. Please feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions. I know we're going to take a couple here now, but if you have any other questions, I'm happy to converse by email or by phone. And I appreciate your time today letting me talk. Thank you so much, Christine.
Oh, this was terrific, Christy. Thank you so very much for sharing all this information and all these strategies. I think it's really important information, and we're glad that you could share this with us. We're going to go ahead and take some calls. I'm going to unmute the lines in just a few minutes. I would ask that in order to preserve call quality, if you could please mute your own phones either by pressing the mute button on your cell phone or by using *6. That will help us be able to hear one another without a lot of background noise. So another way you can ask a question if you do not want to speak on the call is to email me at outreach@mitoaction.org. And I'm happy to read the question and ask Christy directly as well. So a couple of options there. I'm going to go ahead and start the Q&A just by asking one quick question, and that is, how do you go about finding a medical home without raising concerns about doctor shopping? That's one thing that we've talked a lot about with other advocacy presentations, and I'm just wondering, what are some of the things that you want to do to make sure that it's a process that you go through, but it doesn't get read improperly by other physicians?
Great question. Yeah, that's why I really encourage people to ask about that initial consult for 15-minute type time frame to talk with a doctor. I can give a personal example. When we moved from Texas to Pennsylvania, I did a lot of phone calls of, you know, I'd made my list, my short list of maybe 5 or 10 possible pediatricians. And then I did a lot of phone calls talking, you know, asking those initial questions up front. There were some specific questions that I had about how the offices worked. I just found in, you know, in our experience so far that I worked better with certain types of offices that had certain types of availability. So asking some of those questions up front, I think is so important. And then getting a chance to ask a couple of those things that are really important to you, such as, you know, are you willing to learn beside me about mitochondrial disease for my child, can be talked about in a quick 15-minute consult if the physician's willing to do that. And then you're not a patient of record yet. You haven't paid them anything. You have not transferred your medical records to them. You're not their patient at that point. You're really just in your discovery and your information finding phase. So I encourage people to do as much of that up front. That's not to say that, you know, you might pick a doctor and you find out that it's really just not the match made in heaven that you thought it would be. I do encourage people, though, to not just walk away at the first sign of conflict or the first sign of this isn't the perfect relationship, to really give both the physician and the office some grace and really see if you can work through some of those. I find sometimes just having an honest conversation with the doctor saying, I am frustrated, I am overwhelmed, I am not sure what our next step should be, can you help me with this? Or, you know, it's frustrating that we go for a lab draw and we don't get lab results. How can I help facilitate this in the future? Be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem and complaining about the problem can really go a long way to strengthening these relationships.
That's excellent advice, and thank you for that, Christy. I think let's go ahead and open up the lines now. Again, to mute yourself, it's *6, or you can also just use the button on your phone, and you will hear a series of beeps, and then we'll go ahead and take some questions.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, this is the beginning of the Q&A session. Who would like to ask a question? Okay, I've got
it. Hi, this is Mary Beth.
Hi, Mary Beth.
A great presentation. I am so wholeheartedly behind the home, the medical home, and having a quarterback just to get better care, take some pressure off the parents and the families, and, you know, just breathe a little bit to have somebody overseeing all your body systems and not just looking at that one little component like, you know, muscle or neuro or something. So awesome presentation, Christy. Loved it.
Thank you, Mary Beth, for all your help.
Oh, you're welcome. So just as far as what I hear so much from Mito 411, and probably more on the adult side, but also sometimes with the kids and the parents, is they have burned through quite a few physicians for a number of reasons. The relationship isn't working out. Sometimes the physician drops the patient because they're, you know, a whole host of reasons, too difficult, too complex, you know, whatever the reasons. So, you know, some of these callers are getting labeled as difficult patients, and they're just finding it more and more difficult to find that home. So I didn't know if, you know, I know you talked about being respectful and being nice. What else can these patients do to sort of, you know, ensure that their home is going to be standing in the next 5 years kind of thing?
Right. It's a tough one because, as we all know, mitochondrial disease is complex and it's not a one drug or one therapy solution to the challenges that our families face. So I think trying to minimize some of the difficultiness of it, I guess, trying to simplify in your own mind what your top concerns are and focusing on that. I think it's so easy to become so overwhelmed with the enormity of mitochondrial disease that sometimes we lose sight of what is your our daily obstacle. And refocusing that conversation back to quality of life, I think can be really, really helpful. And what I wanted to say is, as I was doing some of the research on some of the programs that are available on the pediatric side, a lot of times palliative care does come up in the searches for complex kids. And I know that's a scary word, a scary term, as is hospice for adults. But reaching out in maybe some of those situations, not that this is maybe end of life, but this is quality of life, and having some of those types of conversations with ancillary providers that might be able to talk about more complex care might be an option as well.
Sounds great. Thank you. I also just wanted to add, Christy, the med peds that you were talking about, they also have the advantage, they're wonderful, they have the advantage of being able to treat an entire complex family. And sometimes that is helpful for the med ped to say, oh, yeah, the mom has trouble with hearing. I should really watch that with this child, or whatever symptoms might be sort of flowing through genetically.
Great point. Yeah, I think if we could get to a medical home concept, or medical homes existed where the whole family was being treated by the same person, we would be in nirvana, right?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, this is all incredibly helpful. Thanks to both of you. And I've actually had a question come in via email. This is about insurance companies. You know, you'd mentioned that the goal is for some of these extra services to be reimbursed for the physician. Are there some insurance companies that are doing? I'm hearing.
Can leave her house now, so it's a fucking waste.
Noise on the line. If you are,
I said no.
I'm hearing a little bit of noise on the line. If you're able to mute yourself by using *6 or by using the mute button, that would be terrific, just so we can preserve the call quality. So the question is basically asking, are there some insurance companies that are doing a better job of reimbursing calls, care coordination, and that type of thing than others? And how can you tell when you are selecting an insurance plan?
That's a great question. The way the payment system seems to be going is similarly like many things in the past, is that Medicare sometimes leads the way in the way this all pans out on a payment side of things. So there is a move in a current code that Medicare is using for care coordination, and so that's being done right now. So the way as I've learned about it is that insurance companies often follow what Medicare does, and then Medicaid comes in as well. And so that's good news, I guess, that care coordination piece is actually being reimbursed. Now there are some loopholes, and not loopholes, that's not the right terminology, but some criteria that need to be met before that reimbursement can happen. And so the office needs to be set up to be able to meet those criteria to be able to get reimbursed for that. So again, this whole idea of the medical home and the office being a medical home would allow them and be set up to do that. For some of the other insurance companies, I have seen, this is another place where patient advocates and care coordinators are getting involved at the insurance level, where they're employed by the insurance company. So sometimes you can ask to have a care coordinator or a special needs coordinator with your insurance company help you navigate from the insurance side of things. So that person is quote-unquote being reimbursed, but by the insurance company directly. And I just I think these people can be tremendously helpful, but I also, one word of caution is that you have to consider everyone's allegiance in who they're being paid by. And so not that that person means any harm or anything to a family, but they are being paid by the insurance company, and so their allegiance is first to their employer. So that's where the idea of private patient advocates comes in, where you might want to consider somebody who's actually advocating directly for your family.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Christy. Is there anyone on the line who would like to ask a question at this time? Okay. Well, I've got one more that I just wanted to ask before we wrap up. This comes up a lot in my experience that, perhaps someone likes the personality of their physician, but the physician is not working in a medical home model. What are some strategies that patients can employ to encourage their existing doctor to shift to a medical home model?
Great question. So I think as I said, I think we're moving in this direction for all healthcare. I just think it's a slower process. So it's possible to ask possibly your physician if the office is in looking at any initiatives that might be coming up in the medical home field. For instance, when I worked with the American Academy of Pediatrics here in Pennsylvania, their medical home program, they were working with their pediatric practices in Pennsylvania to help them with this transition process, because it can be, it doesn't happen, it's not like all of a sudden we say we're going to be a medical home and tomorrow we're a medical home. Usually it's, a couple, possibly a year to 2 year process in this transformation. So just inquiring if the office is even possibly in the process of doing that you might, it's all kind of behind the scenes and the patient might not know that until maybe they start advertising that, or maybe they start letting their patient population know that. So asking about it, I think, is a great first step. If they are maybe really early in that process and you are really interested in maintaining that relationship with that physician, you might ask, are you building a patient advisory board? Are you looking for patient involvement? Because oftentimes with many of these programs, the patient involvement at the practice level is a criteria. And so I know for the medical homes that I was working with in Pennsylvania here through the AAP's program, I was the parent advisor that was going out and helping those practices in Western Pennsylvania connect with patients in their practice and form advisory boards and have input coming back to them from their patients. So it's a great opportunity if they're even thinking about it. You might be able to help get the ball rolling by saying, hey, I'm interested and could I help out? Not that many of us have much time to volunteer to our doctor's office, but, if it means improved care for your child or your family, it might be worth, a meeting a month to give input and to give constructive criticism and to give suggestions on how that office could be better.
That's terrific. Yeah, great ideas. And thank you, Christy. Are there any final questions before we wrap up?
I do have one question.
Yes, go ahead.
Does anyone happen to know what the Medicare code for care coordination is?
I do not have that right up on my screen, but I could probably get it for you fairly quickly. Do you want to leave your email? I could send it to you, or let's see. Let me see if I can get it real quickly on my computer here.
Oh, thank you.
Actually, Christy, this is Mary Beth. You could send it to me, and I could send it to the caller, and that way she wouldn't have to make her email public.
Okay. Let's see.
That's great. Thank you, Mary Beth.
Let's see. I think I put in, I'm thinking if you just Google Medicare care coordination. Oh, there it was, codes. Hang on. I have it. Chronic Care Management Services is the name of this flyer that I pulled up from the Department of Health and Human Services. And it is, let's see if it has a box for the codes. Yeah, it has a whole procedure here on the guidance and, again, those things that they have to meet to be able to use the codes. So it looks like it's a CPT code of 99490. It looks like, and again, this whole document is out there. It is at cms.gov/outreach and education, and it's Medicare Learning Network. But it's a whole, the title of this document is Chronic Care Management Services. And it began January 1st, 2015. Medicare pays on a non-face-to-face care coordination services, 99490.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you.
And okay. I actually just sent it to the caller. So
okay, great.
So perfect. That's a great question. Is there anybody else who would like to?
I'm going to send you the link to this, so maybe you could add it to the blog.
Certainly
is that okay?
Will. That's okay. Great. That's perfect. It's a really helpful document. So great question. All right. Are there any last questions before we wrap up?
This isn't a question. This is Kathy Rivers. And Christy, that was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
Hi. When you were saying call the doctor and ask if they're accepting new patients, is the answer yes or no? One thing I found is really helpful is if they say no, to say, is there a waiting list that I can be put on? Can you call me
Excellent.
In the event of cancellation? And I've used that so many times. And you often will be able to get in. It might not be right away, but at least it's not a forever no. The other thought I had was when you were saying that nurses are great sources of information about who are the good people who like to take care of children or adults with complex illnesses, sometimes when I'll have a name of one doctor and I'll call the office, and as I'm speaking with the office manager or the nurse, I say, hey, can you tell me which of your doctors really likes the patients that are a diagnostic puzzle or a real complex to take care of? Because they know. And it might not even be the first name you had, or there might be more than one. But you're right, nurses are, they know what's happening. They're wonderful sources of information for this. And thank you so much. It was a fabulous talk.
Oh, thank you.
That is great, great feedback. I think that's also extremely important. So thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was really helpful, Christy. Thank you so very much. And if anybody would like to reach out to Christy, her website is empoweredadvocacy.com. We've got that listed on our blog post about this presentation, so you can contact her through that website. But again, thank you so much, Christy. This was incredibly helpful, and we really appreciate your time today. Have a great
weekend,
everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.